we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to yet another episode of How Did It Make Sense? So today we've got a couple of fellow Lundites, graduates from the Masters of Human Factors and System Safety, and we've already got a couple of those already in here. And it's great to see Liam and Nate come and talk about their research, which was sort of based on some real sort of events that occurred. Brief introductions. Liam, who are you? What do you do? Where can people find you in the real world? How did you get to where you are? And if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Gareth, appreciate the opportunity to be here with Nate especially, and the chance to kind of talk through these sort of concepts. Different answers to your questions. My name is Liam. I'm going on a 28-year veteran in policing in the U.S. here, specifically in Minnesota in the Midwest. Worked for a number of different agencies for different reasons, and all by choice made moves to kind of change the experience that I've had. So I've been really blessed to be in this line of work over all these years. I've worked my way from all positions, from a recruit police officer all the way now to serving as chief of police for a suburb of the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And in that breadth of experience, been again blessed to be in a number of different assignments, everything from training to supervision to vice and narcotics to different investigative roles and specialties like SWAT. So really had an excellent opportunity over the years to work in a number of different areas in this state and in the job. Been fortunate also to work all over the country and outside the country as well, specializing in the use of force or the force response areas for police officers, which is really what led to the passion and interest that led to the path to Loon University for the human factors and the three of us meeting there, but really wanted to dive a lot deeper into the systems and how policing really is a system, whereas historically we've looked at it as individuals and individual actions, but wanted to dive deeper into that. So found my way to Lund and mind-blowing conversations that hurt many times with folks like yourself, Gareth, and excellent humans like Nate. So excited to be here and dive a little bit into how Nate and I came to be looking at first story, second story, and systems influence, in this case, in policing.
Excellent.
And Gareth, I should say, you talked about how to get a hold of me. So I don't know if you're able to facilitate links. I tend to avoid social media as best I can, but LinkedIn is one platform that I do use for connections and discussions, and so can provide that access. Yeah. And that's probably the best way to get in touch with me.
Brilliant. I will put your LinkedIn profile in the show notes and people can get hold of you there. So Nate, tell us your background, a little bio, and how you got to where you are, what you're doing now, again, where people can get hold of you, because you've got an amazing story too.
A little bit. I feel like Liam's is so much more exciting. Thanks for having me. So happy to be here with you all today. My career started as a juvenile detention center officer. I've worked there for a little bit. I promoted to a juvenile probation officer, and then I moved on to adult probation, where I supervised felony offenders there, including some sex offenders for Tennessee, the state of Tennessee, and then the state of Georgia. Then I found myself working for the Tennessee Department of Children's Services as a child abuse investigator. I worked there for several years. And then I was introduced to human factor system safety by Noel Hengelbrock. And we introduced or infused human factor system safety into the way that we reviewed critical incidents within our system there at the Department of Children's Services, critical incidents such as fatalities and near fatalities. So we were one of the first child welfare agencies to get some notoriety from that, from the federal government. And it was, it's just mind blowing how we started to change or shift a culture to a safety culture. And then I later did some consulting with Noel and collaborative safety, consulting across the United States with different health and human services jurisdictions, implementing or incorporating the safety science into their critical incident review processes. How to find me on LinkedIn? The same. I don't do a lot of social media, but LinkedIn would be the best place to find me.
Cool. Excellent. And I think what we'll do as well is put the thesis, your thesis, I'll put into the show notes, plus a bunch of other papers, I think, to bring this stuff to life, because it's quite amazing listening to the conversations from Casey Noel at Lund talking about how the shift in state legislature happened when you start bringing this to life. But it's not a 5-minute job. It takes years to do it, but it is quite something. And the fact that you can change that and you can change people's approaches and start taking a systems approach is pretty impressive. So hats off to all of the team that have done change in that space. So this is all about storytelling. What is the first story that made up your thesis research? And, you know, we've got a sort of two people here. So Liam, do you want to start with, you know, what that story is, and then Natay, the sort of the background behind that, before we then move into the second story?
Yeah, absolutely. So the genesis of this, really, credit goes to Natay, as we were there at Lund kind of thinking through, you know, what type of research, what type of dive can we do when we're looking at system safety and human factors. And Natay asked and wanted to kind of explore the police world in terms of use of force, and her proximity to that through child welfare and human services obviously is very close, and me working in the business. So what we wanted to do and ended up doing for our research was taking sort of a ripped from the headlines approach and looking at a police use of force that involved in the end a tragic and fatal outcome. And without telling an exact story, really looked at a number of different incidents put together, obviously whitewashing the details of the real people behind these, but taking some of the similar factors. What we looked at was a situation with a male who was suicidal. Other people knew and saw some of the behavior. The behavior was out in public, and so people called the police department, stating there's a male out there, sounds like he's upset or angry. He might have a gun with him, and he's out in the intersection here or on the street there, and we're concerned about it. And then going through what the police response was or might be in a situation like that, police officers then interacting with this individual who did in fact have a gun, and then talking through, as Natay will talk about, between first story and second story, some of the action that happened in the interim, the police officers interacting with the subject, that ultimately in the end, in this scenario or in this research situation, ended up in a fatal shooting, the police officers making a decision that they needed to shoot this person in defense of themselves or others. And so I'm very much oversimplifying it. Unfortunately, a situation that repeats itself not only in the U.S. but all over the world, where police and citizens encounter each other in crisis or stressful situations. And in this case, as the tale talk about, understanding the first story gets told in specific ways, and then trying to dive deeper into some of the more detail behind it.
Absolutely. So thank you for that, Liam. And Natay, so give us a little bit of background about how and why that first story is told the way it is, and what came out of your research.
So generally in the first story, the media, and we did focus on how the media portrays how stories happen or things or incidents, critical incidents, such as those that are critical incidents that involve law enforcement in the community. We only get a glimpse of what occurred. And usually we get someone blamed for the shooting, blamed for what occurred, and that's typically the officer. We don't get that in-depth look at why they made the decision that they made. There's privacy laws, there's, you know, the clickbait that media wants as well. So we don't get that in-depth look at what they were weighing, what options were they weighing, because it's a critical incident. It's a critical and crisis environment. They want to go home at night. They want to make sure that the people, the community goes home as well. And everyone is a victim, so to speak, in the situation. So it's not, you know, what happened? What did you do? It's what happened to you. So that first story only gives us a glimpse of a surface level, a glimpse or explanation of what occurred. Someone had a mental health crisis or they were in crisis, and then they were, you know, somewhat the officer used force, or the use of force was used. So we don't get all of the information that leads to oversimplifying and the community and the public making some assumptions and filling in the blanks based on their prior experience or based on prior media that they looked at or read or heard. And it's not always accurate. And it leads to simplifying what truly happened. So challenging ourselves to look a little bit deeper, much deeper than the surface, understanding that this was more of a symptom that came up to the surface, that this is our opportunity to learn more. Because if we want to start to learn about our system and start to get more favorable outcomes, we need to challenge ourselves to look at the system that's impacting the decisions that are made in real time. Those officers aren't making decisions in a vacuum. They aren't just going out there just using their weapon without the knowledge of, you know, or understanding the consequence behind firing that weapon. I was issued a weapon at one time. I was a certified peace officer, so that it's not like I don't take that lightly when you have to pull your weapon. For the public to understand that and grasp that so that they get meaningful and useful information so that we can then start to understand that second story so that we can make improvements to the system.
So it's really good. And actually, your research influenced something that I did last year for some of the research that I'm doing in the diving space. And that was to tell a short story, a simplified first story, and then ask people what their thoughts were about where the cause or the blame might be attributed. And I think, you know, that's something that you did. So when you ran that first story through your research subjects, where was their focus on the cause of this event?
Their focus was made on the victim. Their focus was on the victim, and there was sympathy for the victim. And then there was blame, wondering why the officer didn't utilize other tactics, wondering where other resources were, wondering where that, you know, we hear in general, and I had a general understanding of different levels of force and that officers have to go through different levels of force. And I had to run that by Liam because I only heard that through the media. And so I'm not getting a good educated knowledge. No one's speaking from a knowledgeable place until I know someone who has that training. So, of course, our focus groups went to that place of, well, why didn't they utilize a mobile crisis unit? Or why didn't the officer utilize a taser or something of the sort? So that's where their focus was mainly when we gave them the
lots of counterfactuals that are present inside that of should have, could have, would have, failed to. Yes. Loss of essay, you know, all of those bits that we're talking about. So it aligns with the research that I did and the other researching, you know, that's out there. Basically, when we have a simple linear first story, people make assumptions based on their sense making as an observer about that event, based on, you know, it could be their own experience of the media, or it could be their own experience, personal experiences. So what was the second story behind this? And I don't know who's going to lead with this one, But there's you know, reading the papers, you know, that your thesis when you wrote it, it's like, wow, there is so much stuff here, as that's always the case. And that's why I run this podcast, is because we get to see and hear these different stories. So what was this second story behind this sort of amalgamated event that was there?
I'll start real quick here, but I'd appreciate if you go kind of in more detail on the second story concept. So it really, and Gareth, you started talking about the counterfactuals. When we told the first story, the response overwhelmingly was it shouldn't have happened, period, right? And I always use the example, anyone who's ever been involved in a committed relationship for a period of time has had an argument with their significant other over something easy or simple. And the significant other said, you shouldn't have done that. This shouldn't have happened. And the response, of course, is awesome. Thanks for letting me know that. I, of course, know I shouldn't have left my socks here. I shouldn't have run into the garage. But the title of like Loon's program and systems thinking should really simply be this. It's not that simple, right? Because it's never just that. And that really was the shift between the first story and second story was, when the first story was all that was known, the splash from the headlines, the response from the research focus groups was, well, that simply shouldn't have happened. And then went to blame. And they're right if they're only given tiny little bits of the actual whole story. So take any incident that's ever happened, whether it's digital or human based, when you focus on the outcome, the response is simply it shouldn't have happened. But then when we start into the second story and start diving into, well, here's the puzzle, the whole puzzle, not simply the one piece of a tragic ending or a financial crisis. When we started telling the second story and providing the systems aspect, well, the officer is one person in this event, but now we start looking at budgets and training and hiring and retention and city council decisions and other influences that were happening around the officers that were involved, and influences happening with the subject here. Because it isn't as simple as, again, go back to a conversation between my wife and I, two words that start with the letter E, excuse and explanation. I'm not providing an excuse. We weren't looking to excuse a tragic ending in a police-citizen encounter. We were trying to provide explanation as to factors that were involved. And then people ultimately in the end are still going to make up their decision as to what they believe happened or why or how. So for us in this, telling the second story was going much deeper. And instead of providing one piece of a 1,000-piece puzzle, our goal was to provide as many of those 1,000 pieces as we could to then again provide and go back to the research subjects to say, how do you tell me more about what you're thinking now? So Is that at least a setup on second story, if you want to go deeper in that?
Absolutely. So who better to tell us why they made the decision that they made than the person that made it, right? And sometimes in Health and Human Services, the front line doesn't get that opportunity. And because sometimes there are some, you know, punitive actions that could happen, they're protecting themselves or what have you. So being able to engage, and for our second story, where we were able to just give more information as if we engaged the officer that made the decision. So when, you know, giving that officer the opportunity to say why or why not they didn't use taser, why or why not they didn't call crisis. Well, they did call crisis, but because there's budget cuts to the mobile crisis team, there's only one person available. And at the time, you know, it was going to take them an hour to get to the scene. Well, this is a crisis moment. They didn't have an hour to wait. And that led us to budget cuts. Well, it was a budget cut that, you know, trickled down to us not them not having that option of the mobile crisis, or them not being trained in tasering, that only one person could use that option at the time, and they weren't available and they were on their way. And that's because of retention. That's because of turnover. So starting to explore how those decisions are made at a higher level, legislative, government, city councilmen, things of that sort, those who manage the budget, those who are policy holders, how that trickles down, and then how it's applied on the front line. What does it look like when someone is in a crisis moment and they do need mobile crisis, they do need assistance from another officer or from a community resource, but we're cutting them. And although the city or county or state, they're saving money, but how is that impacting those who are doing the frontline work every day to be successful? Because we don't want to go back and blame someone, right? Because they're acting as how they're influenced by the system. They're only making the decisions that are best for them, because we make decisions that are best for us in real time. We want successful outcomes. Nobody wants a tragedy. Nobody wants a crisis. Nobody wants a critical incident. But in real time, we
make decisions. And I think the bit from that as well is understanding that those who are very much in the front line, both in human services, law enforcement, are successful because they're adaptive and creative and they get stuff done. And when they do this, when they've got limited resources, they lead to successful outcomes. And what isn't seen is how much of the salami slice is happening and the capabilities eroded, but we still deliver the outcomes. And so those in sort of financial decision-making positions sit there and go, well, you managed to deal with that when we took 10% off. We'll take another 5%, or we'll take another 10% off. And you still deliver, because nobody wants to say stop, because they've got their professional pride at hand, because they believe in what they do and they're trying to do the best they can. And then we end up with a crisis and a tragic outcome. And then people look at this and go, you know, that classic bit of we work in deltas, not in absolutes, that we have these little steps and we go from this point to this point and go, how did you miss this huge gap in capability? It's like, because we were only looking at the little pieces and we're managing those deltas really well until we run out of capacity.
A critical incident occurs. Then we have those reactive responses, right? We want something done. We want somebody to pay. Or we don't blame someone, and then we go in with some kind of fix. But what if we didn't do that? Wonder if we start to engage workers real time, understanding what their challenges or barriers are to being successful. How are they successful? What kind of workarounds are they creating just to be successful, meeting metrics within their work environment? Wonder if we engage with them to find out, to make so that we can make those system improvements so we don't have to get to those critical incidents all the time. We can have better outcomes more often.
It's an interesting concept in any domain, right? The concept of speaking on, I'll call it near misses, right? So if I'm afraid to tell my story that on this call for service that almost went horrific, you know, the ship's captain is afraid to say, boy, we almost crashed into this thing, or the airplane pilot, man, we almost crashed but for this. And it, at least in law enforcement, and I don't pretend to think it isn't very same or similar in many domains, there's a huge nervousness, even fear, of telling that near miss story. For fear of the simple individual blame. And yet the ability to learn, all right, tell me more about what happened. Tell me more about the little
how did you recover it? You know, it didn't end up as a bad event. What was it you did to recover that situation? How did you notice that it was going south and you were able to intervene at the right time to be able to capture it and steer it back to where we needed to be? Because those are the critical learning points that we can pass on. But if we don't share those stories of things that, hey, that was close, then we never find out those things.
And it's hard to know, right? We use the concept of don't confuse good luck with good tactics. Simply because things turned out excellent doesn't mean anything along the way went excellent. And especially in human-to-human interactions, right? If you're trying to guide foster families along the way to successful, you know, fostering, there's so many little pieces that Nate could speak on that if you never hear the family say, well, but this thing happened. And the same with police officers. If you If you never hear the, well, here's the little details, suddenly it changes the entire picture of everything on how it
works. I feel like what Liam is discussing is creating that culture. In order to create that culture where we can, officers or frontline workers in any industry, can start to talk about those near misses or, you know, those challenges, those barriers, things that they're dealing with. It's creating that culture where they feel safe enough to say that, that psychological safety, that if someone says that, you know, tells you about the near misses or this is what happened and this is what's not working for me in the system, that they won't be, you know, ostracized or not trusted anymore or told that this may not be the best fit for you anymore as far as your job or, you know, or try harder, do better. So, Chris, you know, with what you have.
Oh, totally.
And we did hear that, though, in the first story. Do you recall that? Like, one person said, well, this is just excuses. Well, and we heard that on the second story, too. Well, this is just excuses because everyone's dealing with short staffing. Everyone deals with budget cuts. So this is just excuses. So, no, it's more of an explanation. So when you hear that, instead of saying that, you know, in your mind, saying that it's just an excuse, you challenge yourself. No, it's more of an explanation. Maybe that's something wrong with me hearing that, hearing what those challenges and barriers are. Is it judgment? Am I just going quickly to blame? Hindsight bias.
Yeah, I had a really interesting conversation, online conversation with somebody following a fatality a number of years ago. I put a blog together and somebody said, they said, well, we just need to have empathy because that's the way we trigger a change in our behavior. And I said, do you mean empathy for the victim or do you mean empathy towards the diving instructor? And it's like, no, you can't have empathy towards the diving instructor. They're the one that led to the fatality. It's like, yeah, you've got to have empathy with them to realize the situation they're in, that they, you know, they're a product of this. And it was a really interesting piece that sit there going, actually, that's a huge shift to sit there and say, how can I have empathy with what I would say is the perpetrator of this crime, which actually they didn't intend to go out and do this. This was an accidental outcome and they inherited, or they were a product of a broken system. And that's a huge shift in trying to move that across.
That's a great point, Gareth. And it really goes toward that, the concept of, if you believe employee A, team member B, dive instructor C showed up to work that day and wanted someone to be injured or killed. If you believe that, we have a whole different conversation to be had, right?
Richard.
If you believe the healthcare worker, the pilot, whatever, showed up with that intent, different. But if we believe people show up to work trying to do good work, maybe not even great work, we hope,
assume,
but maybe
good
not.
Intent.
If we assume they're trying to do their job at least moderately well, then the question becomes more so why did it make sense to them? And accepting that humans always, they make decisions that make sense to them and they do it trying to predict the future. I'm about to do this thing. And when I push this lever up, I believe the future is going to, the flap is going to do this. When I assign this child to this family, I believe this is the, where they're going to be successful. The police officer, when I say these words to this person, I believe they're going to react this way. And it's not until the future doesn't happen the way they thought that they then have to go back, reformulate new action and a new plan. And that comes down to people trying to do the best they can do in those moments.
What they're being rewarded for. I think one of the most powerful bits that I got from the collaborative safety work was the fact of, okay, if you're the influence that happened, they said, if you're going to give us a new rule, you've got to tell us the rule you're going to take away. Because you get to that stage where people, their value of good work is compliance. We have to check this. We have to do that. We have to do the paperwork. As opposed to having a relationship with a child to find out what's going on. And so the understanding that compliance was driving behaviors, I think was a really powerful piece for me.
I think it's a powerful piece for agencies as well. During my time that I was with Collaborative Safety and working with the different jurisdictions and different health and human services, For child welfare, even as a practitioner in child welfare, no one took anything away. There was always additions to more policies, more protocols, more metrics, more things to meet. So to then start to hear someone be an advocate and hear the voice from the front line and say, well, okay, well, if you want them to meet this metric and you want to apply this new policy or make some adjustments, what are you going to take away? It's almost like refreshing. Like, you're going to take something away so that I can be successful, maybe meet a metric. So yeah, it's a new idea. It is. And it's helpful. I wanted to jog your memory on Scott Snook. Do you remember reading Friendly Fire?
Yes. I love it.
Yes. And I feel like, you know, that book played a pivotal part in the thesis that we wrote, just him going in to explore. And Scott Snook, for those that don't know, like in 1994, Black Hawk helicopters were shot down. It was Friendly Fire, and it was all peacemakers, 26 peacemakers, U.S. peacemakers on that helicopter. And, you know, everybody, they really didn't find a smoking gun. They didn't find anyone to blame, even though they wanted to find someone to blame, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But then Scott Snook, being a victim of Friendly Fire himself, went in and looked and started to engage those who were doing the work. And he found that everybody was operating and behaving as they should, according to the policies, according to the protocols that were at hand. It was just simply, in a complex environment, an accident happened. Being able to engage those who are working in the environment that they are working in, hearing their perspective, I think that, again, it's a novel idea, and getting that information, knowing that those who do the work every day have the most information, most valuable information about how your system is operating, and can lend a lot of good information as to how you can improve your system. That was one of my favorite readings from Lund.
Do you think, Nate and Gareth, I'd ask you both, right? And Nate, you just kind of hit on it. And I always bring it back to relationships again, because we've all had them or have them, but it applies there in our jobs. My wife and I have started asking questions like, why are things going well, right? Why did we, and not that we fight all the time, but we'll ask a question like, why are we not fighting right now? And that reverse view of the world, why did it almost never happen that we have Black Hawk helicopters shot down? Why are diving accidents, I would guess, Gareth, pretty rare? So while there's plenty to be learned when an outcome is less than ideal, it appears to me there's just as much, if not more, to learn. And sometimes the answer is luck, but most often it's not. Why are we not losing more divers? Why are we not losing more children? Yeah. Why do we not shoot down more helicopters?
Yes, agreed. And I think we're reluctant to look at the good. We always want to be reactive to when something goes bad. You're like, put it in the headlines. It's clickbait. Let the media capture it. This is what people want to see. But what about the good that workers do every day?
I think that, absolutely. And I think one of the bits that really got to me about the Friendly Fire event was, it wasn't just one set of stakeholders. It wasn't just the F-15 pilots, and it wasn't just the Black Hawk pilots. It wasn't just the AWACS crew. They were all operating in their own little space and their own little stakeholder groups, and they were spreading from what they considered to be acceptable. They were still in the bounds of what we're talking about. And I think if we bring this into many other spaces where we've got operational workers, we've got frontline supervisors, we've got the office decision makers, they're all operating in their own capacity space, their own little bubble. And they think they've got probably more margin to play with than they actually have. And when things get really busy, and you run out of time, that's when things start to collapse.
Yes,
but because most of the time people are dealing with it, then it's all okay. And I think that's one of the hardest bits is my level of margin a piece of your margin, Liam, or a piece of yours, Natay? Because actually I'm working well. We're all working well. But actually when things start to get tight and we've got limited resources, we've got limited capacity, then everything collapses really quickly.
thing you bring up two good points for me. So when you start to hear people working outside their margin or getting very close, you start to hear about practical drift, where people are making adjustments, where they experienced some type of success, you know, working outside the box a little bit, and now they've adapted that. Like, teams have adapted that working outside the box, and it's kind of a drift to, you know, acceptance. And then what about multiple perspectives? We want to hear everybody's side. We want to hear from those different, not just from the Blackhawk operators, but from everyone. We want to hear those from working in, because we do tend to sometimes work in silos. So we want to hear what your perspective is from your seat in the house. So from an officer, from our thesis, from the officer's perspective, it's going to be different than that perspective of a community stakeholder. From
the media.
Or the media, or someone like me who doesn't understand everything that goes in to law enforcement training. So hearing everyone's perspective is very valuable, so that you can hear, it's an opportunity to learn. It's a learning moment.
Totally. Liam?
Yeah, I love the concept of margins. I use this concept sometimes with recruits, right? And I'll say, Microsoft Word doesn't have a margin template small enough for you, because when you're brand new in the job, there's no experience, there's no nothing, right? And so your margins are that small because you haven't even learned how or what to do. You've never dealt, you know, I joke, we're bringing kids into the profession these days, and I say kids respectfully, but who have yet to have a boyfriend or a girlfriend. They're just that young. They've never even experienced a relationship, but then I need them to go respond to a domestic between two 80-year-olds who've been fighting for 65 years. And I need you to fix it, right? And I need you to fix it in the right way. Well, that's impossible. They've never even seen the thing, right? And yet, so in policing, roughly in the United States, 60 million face-to-face contacts every year, all U.S. police have, 60 million. Of that number, U.S. police shoot and kill about 1,000 people. So if you just stop with those two numbers, 60 million face-to-face contacts, 1,000 are shot and killed by police. If you played that narrative to the public and said it this way, U.S. police did not shoot and kill 59,998,000 people. No one would even have a conversation anymore, because they'd be like, wow, that's an amazing number that nothing ever happens, right? But when you play it the reverse way, it sounds very different. And going back to margins, you know, my experienced officers of 10, 15, 20, 35 years have seen so much stuff that their margins in terms of where they get to drift lines are much bigger. But on a call for service, I might have an officer who's 21 years old, started yesterday, has had no life experience, and they're faced with a life and death situation for which they've never seen the playbook yet in real life.
Yeah.
Not the same margin. Well, that's a very different contact of those 60 million than someone else.
Well, it's a great way of thinking about it, of how you reverse those numbers and how we present stuff, how we frame stuff.
Yes.
And I think one of the hardest bits is, you know, the public just sees the police or law enforcement or social services as this all-seeing, all-knowing body of experts, because that's where they are. Mm-hmm. And you have this spectrum of, I'm going to use the term technically, incompetence through to experts. And you have this spectrum, and you can't expect the incompetent novice to behave and think the same way as the expert, even if the public ascribes everybody to be on the right-hand side of that spectrum.
Well, you even think about, new workers versus seasoned workers. And then if you continue to have high turnover, you will start to have more newer workers that don't have, you know, that experience like seasoned workers that had more contact with families, that has experienced a lot of different crisis environments or experienced different type of situations with families. Versus just like I was brand new into child welfare without any children. So I was going out talking to families about parenting and keeping children safe. I had no children.
What do you know about parenting
then?
I know,
yes, exactly. And sometimes I could see how green I was because I was like, shot records, I don't know, like the time that children need to get their shots now that I'm a wonderful stay-at-home mom to a wonderful seven-year-old. I could relate more. And then there's that secondary trauma. Like where you do can relate to people and you're like, oh, wow, that, yeah, I can relate to that, like going out. So then when you have that turnover, then you do have a vast amount of more of newer workers than you do have seasoned workers, and you don't have that.
Everybody grows and learns.
Transfer of knowledge, yeah, from those seasoned workers that's missed. That on the job training mentoring that everybody can appreciate.
You know, it's relevant though, right?
Go on, Liam.
Yeah.
No, go on. This is you. You're talking. Sure.
It's relative, right? Because we also can't make an immediate assumption of, I'll use credibility or experience or knowledge or what have you, simply because someone has the E word experience behind them, right? I recently had some ink work done, that it was going to be pretty involved, a tattoo. And of course, I knew who I was going to go to, and it wasn't going to be an apprentice, right? Or I was going to end up looking like an Andy Warhol stick figure, right? So I wanted the guy who knew what he's doing, right? Been doing it for 25 years. But on the reverse side too, you might have someone who takes for granted their time or their experience and sits back on that a little bit. And so there's so many different nuances to what experience means. There are times I'll take a youthful decision maker at any point because they might be paying a closer level of attention to the thing. But they don't have the experience. And so it's probably the hardest thing for, I think, be outside any domain, right? Diving. I don't have the first damn clue, Gareth, about diving. And so looking from the outside in, it's very easy for me to make judgment. And the same with any other domain, because I don't understand the complexities of that world. I could tell you it looks hard and looks difficult and I don't like water. But beyond that, that's about as far as my knowledge goes, right?
There's a couple of bits that sprung to mind. Let's sort of close this down before we then sort of go for a summary piece. One is this: when you were talking, Natay, about expertise, it reminded me of Gary Klein's that experts can see the invisible. So novices wait for something to be present to say that should be there, but experts will spot stuff that's missing, and a novice can't spot that because they don't know it should be there to start with. And the other piece is a personal story. 3 years ago, I had two stents fitted, having had the main lateral anterior descending artery blocked. And when they did the angiogram and then they turned it into an angioplasty, they fitted the stents, there was a consultant and then there's a junior doctor there. And it's just like, this guy's going to cut into my artery and my wrist. And they're going to feed the catheter up through the brachial artery. And it's like, okay, but they have to practice. You know, they have to do it for real. And so you sit there going, you're going to cut. But not me. And you sit there going, yeah, okay. So it's an interesting bit of the only way you get expertise is to go and do it. And that's a really difficult thing in a critical situation where we have to create an environment where people can fail as safely as they can. And that safely is not just about personal safety. It's also about reputational risk. It's about judgment that's going on and understanding that people are making the best decisions they can with the resources, the training, the sense-making that's happening. So,
I have to ask you, and Gareth, could you imagine if it went like this? You want to call 911? Would you like to call the teaching police department or the other real police department? Would you like the teaching driver instructor or the would you like the teaching human service? I mean, you'd never call that one, but that's the reality of all our worlds, is someone needs to learn and work, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. So the final piece of the podcast is a recommendation of a book, a paper, a video, or or something that sort of influenced your thoughts. And then I'll stick those in the show notes. So, Liam, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about just two specific books, and they've been around for a little while, but I think they're really important, and I think you can find them both on Audible. One is Annie Duke, Thinking in Bets. Annie was a competitive poker player for a very long time, and she talks in this book, among a number of other things, about kind of how poker players make decisions. And she talked about the concept of resulting, which is focusing on the outcome without consideration of what went into it and the other possible outcomes that could have happened. You could talk about outcome bias, right? Equating the outcome with the quality of decisions made along the way. So it's a great book. She does a lot of speaking also. Annie Duke, Thinking in Bets. And the other one is Legacy, the story of the All Blacks footballer team. It's focused in that sports world, but speaks a lot to the concept of failed performance isn't often due to lack of judgment or skill, but the inability to handle pressure at the pivotal moment. And the question becomes, what do we mean by handling pressure? So those two books, I think, are really excellent, apply in any domain, and are good reads or good listens.
Cool, brilliant. I made use of Quit last year, actually, of making those decisions and realizing that actually when you quit, and I didn't go to a conference, I lost some money, but I gained something back in terms of time. So, you know, really aware of the sunk costs that are in there. So yeah, great, great bits. And Natay, what would you recommend?
Absolutely. Friendly Fire. Scott Snick, I already mentioned that. It's just a good read. I just feel like it's a thriller. It's a great detective work. I don't know. It's very captivating, even though, you know, there's some technical language in there, but you can kind of cipher through there. And then I like Charles Perrault, Normal Accidents. I feel like that is the start of it all. And, you know, after Three Mile Island, they asked him, you know, to do an investigation. He wrote this book. We're inspired by Three Mile Island. And he just talks about the complexity of our environments and tightly coupled environments, and that some accidents are normal. That's the gist of things. Some accidents will happen. Things will occur. Just even in contrast, you know, Liam giving us the contrasting numbers. 1,000, there's going to be some accidents. But 59 million other times, there was none. But there are some accidents. Absolutely. Those two books are inspiring to me.
Great. Cool.
Thank you very much, both. And it's great to catch up with you again.
Absolutely.
We've got to do something and have a reunion. I've got some ideas, and it'd be really cool. So thank you very much for your time. We're dotted around different time zones, and I really appreciate your time. So thank you, Liam, and thank you, Natay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gareth. Appreciate it.